Welcome back to Issues Etc. Here in the second hour, we're going to start out talking about St. Timothy, this character that finds himself all over the New Testament. Dr. Peter Scare is going to join us. Dr. Scare, by the way, he's been voted here in the studio most dedicated Issues Etc. guest ever. And I'll tell you why. It was Sunday night, just a couple days ago, while most of you were enjoying the final round before the Super Bowl. Dr. Scare was alone in his darkened office. He thought he might be able to follow the Colts as they were working their way toward victory over the internet, but he found out that his internet didn't work. Why was he there? Why was he missing his Colts victory? Because he was waiting patiently, silently, in the dark, to come on Sunday Night Issues, Etc., our nationally syndicated edition of the program, and follow up an hour by Dr. Wayne Grudem on evangelical feminism. He missed his game. And so we voted him most dedicated guest of Issues, Etc. Oh, by the way, you can hear that interview Friday on the program. Dr. Peter Scare is Assistant Professor of New Testament at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Peter, welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be with you on a Wednesday afternoon.
Yes, and you are eagerly anticipating the Colts showdown there for the Super Bowl. What are you going to do? How are you going to prepare for your team's debut there?
Well, I think there's going to be a lot of gloating that takes place. First, I got to gloat to my brothers who both live in New Hampshire, and it just, as fate happens, my sister lives in Chicago, so I'm looking forward to the day when I can call her up and offer her condolences at her loss. We'll be spending the time here. They have a great Super Bowl party here at the seminary in the auditorium, and everybody gathers together. So I'm psyched, and as is my whole family.
Does Dad have any loyalties in this regard?
You know, he grew up in Brooklyn, so I think and he used to work for the Brooklyn Dodgers as a kid, and I think when the Dodgers moved to Los Angeles, his heart was broken for all sports, and I don't know if he's gotten over it since.
So he's just one of those disgruntled fans like those so many in Baltimore who watch
Lasico. He's a bitter, bitter person. But, living in Indiana, I think we can all find something to be happy about here.
Well, you know, I don't know who I'm going to be rooting for. I work during the Super Bowl, generally speaking, on Sunday nights. So, if I got to toss in my support, I guess it'll be for the ponies there.
Well, I think it's time for a best of show, I think.
Well, yeah, I think that's true. And it wouldn't take much to talk Jeff into that, given the fact that he can't live without a constant infusion of sports. But his drink of choice is basketball, not so much football.
Well, you know, I gave up on NFL football for many years, but it's hard not to be infected by this Peyton Manning phenomenon.
Well, here's Timothy. Most people, if they've just flipped through the New Testament, will know that there are a couple letters from Paul to Timothy. Is he, and they have to do a lot with Timothy as young pastor. Is Timothy the patron saint of pastors?
Yeah, and so, I think what you say, it's interesting. Just looking, you know, at Timothy, as I was thinking about this show, he pops up all over the New Testament, as you said. Not only does he get two letters named after him, which are, you know, dedicated and sent to him, he ends up as the co-sender of another six letters. And then I can think of at least another couple, the Sermon to the Hebrews and Paul's letter to 1 Corinthians. So if my tally is right, I think that makes, I think, nine different documents, you know, offhand that I can think of Timothy in. And Timothy really is, I hadn't thought about it, but he is the patron saint of pastors. And he represents the next generation after the 12 and after Paul. The question, I suppose, would arise, will the church be able to continue? I mean, after the 12 and Paul had the advantage of seeing the risen Christ face to face. Well, what about the next generation? Would there be a next generation that would faithfully carry on and proclaim the same teaching which Christ entrusted to his apostles? And that is represented in the person of Timothy. And I think it is funny. We think of him as the young pastor. He's kind of Robin. He's Robin if St. Paul is Batman, you know. He's always the young pastor. Of course, I'm sure he did mature, and he became a bishop in his own right and a leader in the church. And so today's a great day to honor him, and also to thank God that God continues to supply us with pastors, that he gives us the pastoral ministry as a service to his church.
Where do we first meet him? I mean, if we can not only treat it in terms of how he falls in the letters as either recipient, co-sender, co-author, but chronologically, where do we first meet Timothy in the New Testament?
Well, he's, as far as I know, we first see him after the Jerusalem Council, which is, 49 A.D. After the Jerusalem Council, Paul is ready to begin his mission again in earnest to the Gentiles. And you remember, as he began his ministry, he began it with Barnabas, who was kind of his mentor and helped him, eased him into the Jerusalem circle. And he also had a young colleague, Mark. And there was a fallout or a disagreement because Mark had left Paul during a critical time. And Barnabas saw, potential in Mark. So Barnabas went off with Mark. And those two formed a ministry, I guess we would say team today. And Paul then, Paul needed somebody to join him, and Silas, who was his other partner, and Timothy then joined him. Timothy seems to have been a native of Lystra, which is in Asia Minor in modern-day Turkey, and it was there in Lystra that Paul met Timothy and must have been suitably impressed with him, and Timothy, we see, was raised up in the faith, and there's a nice story there because we do know the names of, this is a family affair. Timothy didn't come out of nowhere. He was raised by a faithful Jewish mother by the name of Lois, and a great name, and a grandmother by the name of Eunice. We have we know her name too. So faithful women who must have brought Timothy up in the Jewish faith and then came to believe in Christ as the Messiah. And we also know that he had a Greek father.
So he is as far as we can tell, on his mother's side, Jewish, on his father's side, Gentile. Does this make him uniquely suited for the ministry that he will eventually carry out there in Asia Minor? He's often associated with Ephesus as its pastor.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's always like as you look at the book of Acts, you do have the church continuing to branch out, or the church is moving, from its Jewish home and from Jerusalem and into the Gentile world. And certainly in that regard, Timothy is got his foot in both worlds. He is a Jewish, as I understand it. If your mother is Jewish, then you are considered to be Jewish. And if your father is Jewish, then you do have to, I believe, then in some way be converted. At the same time, it's interesting. I don't know how. Well, who knows how faithful the Jewish? I mean, I guess I have to backtrack a little because I don't know how faithful the mother would have been, in the sense that we find out that Paul does have to have Timothy circumcised in order that he can go in his ministry to the Jews. So I don't know what to make of that. It's kind of interesting.
You get a mixed picture because you get this: from your infancy, you have learned the scriptures. Who would have been teaching him except his Jewish mother? And then at the same time, that odd little fact that he gets into adulthood without being circumcised.
Well, you know that these kind of anomalies, of course, happen all the time. And there's a very humorous anomaly in the Old Testament where you have Moses' own children. If holy Moses doesn't know how to circumcise his children, and he's the one who wrote the first five books of the Old Testament and told the story of Abraham, and I guess his wife Zipporah, as I recall at least, has to take the matters into her own hands and circumcise the children of Moses. So we all know, I mean, we can laugh at that a little bit because we all know in our own lives that there are inconsistencies.
So what do we know beyond his association with Paul, and at least according to the letters that Paul wrote to him, his tenure in Asia Minor as a pastor? What do we know of him?
Well, you know, he did spend a considerable time in Ephesus. And but it seems when you look at Paul's ministry, he really treats Timothy as kind of his right-hand man. He is, you know, one man cannot do everything. And Paul was a great missionary and a great writer and a great theologian, but one man cannot be everywhere. And he used Timothy as his, it seems to be, his personal representative. And that's why he's so closely associated with Paul. Paul calls him in a number of places. He says he's my, you know, my brother, like my brother in the faith or my brother in the ministry. He's my co-worker. And he also very fondly calls him his child, not son, I don't think, but he says my child, technon. So he's very much thought to, I mean, Paul trusts him enough to carry on his ministry. And a great place where I see it is, for instance, at Corinth, where there was another minister there by the name of Apollos. And my feeling is that when you look at 1 Corinthians, Paul was not all too pleased with what Apollos was doing, and that the congregation was had all sorts of problems with the charismatic the first manifestation of the charismatic movement, and a kind of a cult of personality was going on at Corinth. And there you have Paul saying, you know, what matters in a pastor is that he be a faithful steward. And he says, Timothy is a faithful steward. And then he says, I'm going to send you Timothy. Apollos can't come, but I'm going to send you Timothy, and you receive him as if he were me, and hold to his teaching. So it looks like Paul is able to use Timothy as kind of his personal representative, and then, you know, he can help put out fires here and there. I mean, he's the one who's got to go and help congregations when they seem to be going through some difficulties.
We're talking about New Testament Saint Timothy. Dr. Peter Scare is our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. In about 15 minutes, we're going to discuss a commentary in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch titled Anyone But a Clinton or a Bush. If you have a question or a comment about St. Timothy, give us a call now, 1-800-730-2727 or 505-7850. You can also send us your email, issuesetc@kfuo.org. I want to come back to something you just mentioned, and that is, it seems pretty clear, at least in the first letter that Paul writes to Timothy, there is a formal commissioning of Timothy to carry out Paul's own ministry in Ephesus. He even says, this charge I entrusted to you, Timothy, my child, in accordance with prophecies previously made about you. And then Paul's greatest concern there seems to be that people are wandering away from the true faith. He's left him there to kind of counter false teaching. What can we surmise about the circumstances under which Timothy served as a pastor?
Well, when you look at it, you look at Paul's life, and it's like everything else. You begin with a bang, and maybe you end with a whimper. It reminds me a little, when I look at the trajectory of Paul's ministry, it reminds me a little bit of Luther's own ministry, where you have, here I stand, I cannot do otherwise, and you think, wow, the great things are going to happen, and then you have the signing of the Augsburg Confession, and it seems like a great movement of unity and the birth of the Lutheran Church. And then as Luther's got older, things seemed to be falling apart all around him, and he wondered, you know, would the true gospel continue to be preached? And you look at the end of Paul's own life, and I think he starts to wonder what his own legacy will be. I don't know if there are very few churches which Paul goes to that don't, you know, soon after have troubles, because as soon as you plant the wheat, the devil comes in and sows his tares. And that certainly happened in the congregations that Paul was preaching to. You have all sorts of, difficulties. You would think that following Paul would be the easiest thing as a pastor, because Paul would have laid a very good foundation. But at the same time, you know, the devil knows where to attack, and he certainly attacked the congregations that Paul was planting and laying the foundation for. And these two letters to Timothy, you know, they are letters to Timothy, but it's not quite like they're personal letters to Timothy. These are letters given to Timothy so that he can read them, it seems to me, to the entire congregation. Elsewhere, when you look at the correspondence of Paul, he complains about people who receive letters of recommendation from, you know, so-called leaders in Jerusalem. The letters which are to Timothy are letters given by Paul to Timothy, letters of recommendation for Timothy. He's telling Timothy a lot of the things that he already knows. And he's saying them, of course, for the sake of the people who will be then listener, those who will then listen to Timothy. And the nature of the letters in 1st and 2nd Timothy, you know, he says it bears a lot of the wisdom that Paul has gotten over the years. And the nature of his ministry, it's interesting, Paul is thinking, Timothy's the patron saint of pastors. Well, Paul talks an awful lot about what it means to be a pastor when he talks to Timothy. He says, fan the flame that it was given to you in the laying on of hands. That means, you know, the gift of ordination. Remember who you are. Remember that you are a steward of God's mysteries and be faithful. And elsewhere in the correspondence, he says, for instance, about ordination, he says, don't be hasty in the laying on of hands. I wonder whether Paul didn't ordain some other people maybe too quickly. Who knows? But he learned by this time, he says, it's important that we get it right. Let's ordain good and faithful men, even as I think that you are, Timothy, and you carry on that legacy, because he's giving Timothy's going to have to take the spot or the place that Paul once held as kind of being a leader in the church, a bishop in the church. So, you know, Timothy's going to be given that responsibility, not just for his own congregation, but he's also, you know, we pass this, you know, baton down from generation to generation, and that's what's happening, I think, in his correspondence, 1st and 2nd Timothy.
Let's go to the phone where Kent is waiting in his car. Kent, thank you for being patient. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd. Gentlemen, excellent program as always. Todd, I tell anybody that I ever run into that they have to listen.
Thank you very much.
To Issues, Etc. An incredible program. Doesn't matter. Baptist, Catholic, Lutheran, whoever.
Thank you.
Well, if they're Lutheran, they better be listening anyway. Okay, a couple of points. A subject near and dear to my heart. St. Timothy is also the patron saint against stomach disorders. No, I'm not kidding. It probably has something to do with his martyrdom, but his powerful intercession has never failed me. Now, you're going to say, hey, you can't pray to a saint, to which I say nonsense. I'm not praying to him. Asking for the prayers of St. Timothy is no different than asking a prayer circle at church or asking you to pray for me. He prays with me and for me to the Lord. I don't pray to him for anything.
All right, Kent, thank you. And by the way, before we let you go, Kent, are you a Lutheran? I take he isn't. I take it he isn't. In fact, I think given his remarks there, he's probably one of our Roman Catholic brothers. Well, let's deal with two things. First of all, this whole notion of patron saint, we've raised it already, but also the notion of this prayer to or through or that Kent has raised for us.
Well, I guess first I like to talk about stomach disorders. I think that Paul said to Timothy that take a little bit of wine for your stomach, so that that does have a calming effect, and I guess that's why he was associated with that. And I think Kent's right in the sense that the saints are praying for us. I mean, and I think probably St. Timothy's got, you know, more important things on his mind than simply that our stomachs not ache. I'm sure he's praying for us that we would, the kind of things that St. Paul said, you know, fight the good fight of faith, hold fast to the doctrine, hold fast to the confession. It's very much, those are probably the prayers that he is offering up in heaven on our behalf. We don't pray to him, and all our prayers are to our Heavenly Father through our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, who is our one mediator. But then I don't have any problem with the idea that Timothy might not be made aware of our situation and might be praying for us, but our prayers will be to God alone.
Well, I mean, it's safe to say, and I think this is where we could agree, and that is that just because the saints are dead does not mean that living in Christ, they do not continue to offer intercession.
Oh, well, they could do nothing but. I mean, they are rooting for us all the way. I mean, we should always think that we're running the race, and those who are departed in the faith are cheering us on in the kind of way that Paul cheers Timothy on. Make it to the finish line. Keep running. And then also offering their prayers up on our behalf, because they want nothing more than for us to join them in the heavenly course.
One final quick question. There's a phrase that Paul uses at the end of the first letter to Timothy, which is, guard the deposit entrusted to you. What in the world? You're not talking about money. What's he talking about? 30 seconds here.
Yeah, this is a wonderfully Lutheran idea, and it's a Christian idea that the faith once given by the saints never changes. Faith doesn't. This is the deposit of doctrine, the true teaching, which when Jesus said to the apostles, go therefore and teach all nations, teaching them everything, all the things. And so from generation to generation, we guard this deposit, this faith, and we hand it down to the best of our ability to the next generation.
Dr. Peter Scare is Assistant Professor of New Testament at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. Scare, it's always a pleasure talking with you. Thank you for giving us your time this afternoon.
You're quite welcome. Have a great day.
At Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, they are doing their very best to turn out young men as pastors for the church who can honestly and proudly wear the label that St. Paul put upon young pastor Timothy. He gives him the highest accolade that Paul could give to any servant of the word. You know what that word is? Faithful. He calls him Faithful Timothy. And he even says it of himself. He says, we're stewards of the word of God. And stewards, what do you want out of a steward? That he be found faithful. That's what they're doing at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. They are preparing good and faithful pastors for service of the word and of God's people. Find out more about them. Their toll-free number, 1-800-481-2155, 1-800-481-2155. Or visit our website and find their logo where you can link to more information, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, Christ-centered, cross-focused, Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, producing faithful pastors. When we come back from this break, it's Dr. James Berkey. He's going to join us and explain what he meant when he wrote in a commentary today in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, if Washington's caustic partisan atmosphere is to change, the era of Bushes and Clintons needs to end in 2008. You probably read that today in the paper. We'll have the author of those words and that commentary, Politics Anyone But a Bush or a Clinton, Dr. James Berkey, join us on the other side of the break. Then we'll be talking with Dr. Alvin Schmidt about marriage and divorce in Islam, in particular in Iraq, where what they're talking about is enjoyment marriages. Not marriages, an easy divorce, even among the Muslims. Joe Dallas will be our guest to respond to three very commonly made arguments for gay rights. I think the three arguments are something like innateness, insignificance, and intolerance. We'll find out what they are and the response in the last half hour of Issues, Etc.
Grace, faith, Scripture, and Christ alone. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Next time of the Bible study at 10:05 will be in Luke chapter 18, where Jesus will answer the question, what must I do to inherit eternal life? We'll talk about it with Pastor Tom Hendrick of Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Perryville. Listen to the Bible study. It comes your way weekday mornings at 10:05, followed by Ask the Pastor at 11:05.
The Bible study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
Here at AM 850 KFUO, it's a privilege to say thank you to our caring donors, including Ronald and Adele Trampy of St. Charles, Virgil and Dolores Volker of St. Elmo, Illinois, and Wayne Schluter of Peavely, Missouri. Thanks for making the programs on AM 850 KFUO possible.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. President Bush spoke to the nation last night in his 7th State of the Union address. High on the president's list of priorities, Iraq, health care reform, and energy independence. But it's what wasn't in his speech that's making news today. Steve Jordahl reports the president's current political troubles seem to have taken his eye off the ball.
Recognizing the new reality in Congress, the president's speech started with a plea for bipartisanship, a trait that's been sorely missing in the Capitol in the last several years.
Our citizens don't much care which side of the aisle we sit on, as long as we're willing to cross that aisle when there's work to be done.
The president gave a nod to some quasi-family issues, health care reform, eliminating secret and wasteful spending, and asking Congress to reauthorize his education initiative. The closest he came to speaking to his conservative base was a request for more federal judges.
Mr. President, I have a duty to nominate qualified men and women to vacancies on the federal bench, and the United States Senate has a duty as well to give those nominees a fair hearing and a prompt up or down vote on the Senate floor.
But social conservatives were left wanting on the issues that mean the most to them. Dr. Janice Krause of Concerned Women for America says she expected more.
There was nothing there. He completely dissed the social conservatives. None of the social issues were there.
Tony Perkins of the Family Research Council says the president missed an opportunity.
The president should have challenged this Congress to stand with him on many of these core issues like the preservation of human life, embryonic stem cell research, human cloning, expanded funding for Planned Parenthood.
Absent those remarks, conservatives are left to wonder what 2007 will hold. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
The president's health care initiative will probably affect the most Americans. It would change the tax code to provide income credits to those who have health care. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
On the next Focus on the Family, John and Lisa Bentley shared their story of saving Levi, a baby who had been left to die in a field in China, with serious burns covering 70% of his little body. When the Bentleys took him into their care, the fight for Levi's life began, and this infant wound up uniting people around the world. Don't miss this amazing testimony on the next edition of Focus on the Family.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Our book of the month for January is titled The Blessings of Weekly Communion. What benefits do we receive in the sacrament of the altar? The Blessings of Weekly Communion is published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. You'll also find more information on our website, issuesetc.org. The Blessings of Weekly Communion cost $23.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org.
I don't know, does this summarize your thoughts going into 2008? Anyone but a Bush or a Clinton? There's a commentary in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch today. In fact, it appeared in national papers of that title. We'll be talking with its author, Dr. James Berkey, for the next 15 minutes or so of the program. Dr. James Berkey is Assistant Professor of History at Concordia University, Wisconsin. He's co-founder of the Bipartisan Political Action Committee called Americans for Responsibility in Washington, and he's authored this commentary in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Dr. Berkey, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Good afternoon, Todd. Good to be here.
Here's one of your lines, and it's the one that really jumps up out off the page to me. If Washington's caustic partisan atmosphere is to change, the era of the Bushes and the Clintons needs to end in 2008. What do you mean? Make your case.
It's interesting to talk to people who have been in Washington, D.C., and talk about the partisan atmosphere in D.C. being unlike anything anybody who is there has experienced in modern history. We've got a good friend and someone you're probably familiar with, Todd, Bill Hecht, a Lutheran friend out in the longtime lobbyist in Washington, D.C., who talks about, in 40 years of service, Washington being more partisan than he can ever remember. And some talk about it being more partisan than any time really since the Civil War. Democrats and Republicans unable to even sit down with one another and talk through issues. And that's problematic. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist or a political scientist or a political historian to figure out that if there's another Clinton on the ballot in 2008, that's not going to change because there is nothing. And we've seen this now for 16 years. There's nothing that stirs up anger on the right like a Clinton, and nothing that stirs up anger on the left like a Bush.
So your basic case is, going into 2008, we've got Hillary Clinton most likely, no, nothing's for sure, but most likely sitting on the Democratic ballot for president, and that will simply continue, if not exacerbate, the divide that's in Washington and then extends out into the country.
It will. I think that's going to happen. Something else is likely to happen, though, and this is simply looking back historically at circumstances where we've had children and relatives of presidents, political aristocrats running for office. I think generally they tend to engender a little bit more hostility than your average run-of-the-mill candidate, simply because Americans have a reaction. You know, we're a meritocracy. I think we've got a reaction against somebody who inherits a fortune or inherits an office or seems to inherit a right to run. What that's likely to mean, I believe, is that if Hillary Clinton runs, if she were to win, for example, I think she wouldn't win with more than 51% of the vote. In the same way that her husband was not able to win with more than 50% of the vote, and George W. Bush won a bare plurality or a bare majority in 2004. And when you've got such a small majority, it's bound to exacerbate that kind of hostility. Now, conversely, let's take it historically, even look at in recent history. Our three most popular presidents of the 20th century, Ronald Reagan, Lyndon Johnson, and Franklin Roosevelt, or at least of the mid to late 20th century. Under those presidencies, big things happen. Great challenges are overcome. You may not agree necessarily with the direction it went, but under Franklin Roosevelt, look at the New Deal. Under Roosevelt, under Lyndon Johnson, poverty is tackled. Under Ronald Reagan, the Cold War is ended. You need a politically popular president in order for those kinds of big challenges to be faced head on, and I don't think that is going to happen with a 50.1% president. I think you need a 55% president. Now, we talk about the mandate and the power of the mandate. I think at this particular juncture, where we've not only got a war on terror, but we also have exploding deficits, crises in Social Security and Medicare, things that were referenced in last night's State of the Union address, we're going to need somebody with some political capital to spend in order for those to get tackled.
So it's a two-pronged problem that we face right now, which is we have leaders who have been elected by slim majorities,
mm-hmm.
and these leaders also happen to be, and the next prospective leader from the Democratic ticket happens to be part of what you have called their political aristocracy or dynasties.
Yes.
How would you argue when someone says, look, you can go back to the Roosevelts, though? You had, at a much earlier time in history, Teddy Roosevelt, very effective president in many ways, and then later one of his relatives who served for three terms during the war, and many people wanted the continuity that that brought at a time of national crisis. How would you respond?
That case can be made. You know, there was a fairly indirect connection between Roosevelt, the latter Roosevelt, the former Roosevelt. This wasn't a son or even a first cousin. And it was a pretty unique circumstance. Roosevelt, I remember, got crushed pretty brutally when he was on the vice presidential ticket just a couple of elections before 1932. And rose to popularity because of this incredibly unique circumstance, this growing Great Depression. So this kind of argument isn't going to hold perfectly in every circumstance, but I think generally, when you look at polls today and you find the levels of anger and animosity towards Hillary Clinton, now you've got plenty of people that are rabid supporters, but you find 40% plus of Americans who have been consistently answering for years in polls that they would never under any circumstances vote for Hillary Clinton. We've got, I think, unprecedented, remarkable levels of negativity towards her that are going to be hard to overcome. And again, if we can't have a 55-plus percent president, I think it's far less likely you're going to find somebody reaching across the aisle, because what we've seen in modern history instead is the 50.1% president, particularly with George Bush in office, trying to manage and create remarkable party discipline passing bills with 8, 10, 12-point margins, vote margins in the House and smaller margins in the Senate. And that's problematic. And I think it's out of step also perhaps with what our, with what our founders had intended.
Speak briefly, if you would. Now, this is farther down the line and a little more speculative, but there's another Bush kind of waiting in the wings, the Florida governor, Jeb Bush, and and no one's ruled him out.
He hasn't ruled him out, and his brother has urged him to run down the line, perhaps. The only thing he's ruled out is 2008. That's even more problematic, and it's unfortunate because from everything I read about Jeb Bush, he's actually probably the most the best political talent in that family, and he's been a very effective governor. But again, I think our founders would be spinning in their graves at the prospect of a country governed for three, 4 decades by the same two families. That's highly, highly problematic in a nation with 300 million people, such a deep pool of wealth. And our real wealth is not our money. Our real wealth is the great body of talented Americans who can and do participate in the political process. To rely on just two families is problematic. Now, I think this is emblematic of a bigger problem, because it's not just in the presidency. We see unprecedented incumbency levels in the House of Representatives and in the Senate, which I think are paralleled by and probably caused by, in large part, or supported by, unprecedented levels of money, lobbyist influence in Washington, D.C., and really all related in one way.
So that raises the question. I was thinking about this the other day. I heard someone say that 2008 may be the first time in history when, for both major candidates to pursue the White House, if you pooled the money that they're going to have to spend, it will reach $1 billion to get the White House. Now, no matter how you slice it, that's a lot of money. And I wonder how much those incumbency rates have to do with the fact that you practically have to be a millionaire to set your sights on Washington at any level.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's the incumbency rates, again, and I'll use the example of Wisconsin. Yeah, President Bush visited Concordia University, Wisconsin, at the commencement address a few years ago. And he came here in 2004 because it was Wisconsin's a swing state. It's a 51-49 state, pretty evenly divided blue from red. In Wisconsin, our Senator Herb Kohl, our longtime senator, virtually ran unopposed for office in this past election cycle. And that's by and large because he's a multi-millionaire, and his money just scared out any potential competition. There are high costs associated with running, and I think the people that run tend to run in circles with other people that have money because they're raising money nonstop. I use another example in our own congressional district of our longtime congressman, Congressman Sensenbrenner. He's been serving for about 30 years now. He runs, I'm not going to say unopposed, but he generally wins with about 65% of the vote without much of a campaign effort. Yet still has a committee that raises millions of dollars and has this war chest sitting there, I think, to crush any potential competition. That's problematic, particularly in the House of Representatives, which is the one branch of government that our founders really intended to see high turnover rates in, the one that was really supposed to be closest to the people. And I think when you have turnover and competition, you're going to have a government that's much more responsive. It shouldn't be any surprise to us that as we see this political aristocracy rising in Washington, I think we have a government that is much less responsive to what we want and really what we need right now.
Folks, I'd like to hear from you, our listeners. Do you agree or disagree with the commentary in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch? Anyone but a Clinton or a Bush? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, our in-studio email address, issues, etc., at KFUO.org. We're coming to you live this Wednesday, 24th of January. Dr. James Berkey is our guest. He's Assistant Professor of History at Concordia University, Wisconsin, co-founder of the Bipartisan Political Action Committee called Americans for Responsibility in Washington, and author of this commentary in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch. You also point out in your commentary that along with the candidates comes the whole cadre of advisors, counselors, staff people that does tend to stay the same in these political families.
It does. And all we've got to do is take a look at the current Bush administration. And, you know, one of the most vilified names in the current Bush administration, Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney isn't unfamiliar to people who can look back to the first, to Bush 41's presidency, because he was Bush's Secretary of Defense. And in with these political dynasties come the same supporting staff. We've already seen with the Hillary Clinton candidacy, Terry McAuliffe, a name that is familiar to those of us from the 1990s, who can recall McAuliffe and the DNC and the wads of money that were raised for the Clintons, the coffee clatches, the Lincoln bedroom overnights. There's a name that's already associated with this budding Clinton candidacy. We're going to find other names also. Harold Ickes, Paul Degala, I mentioned possibly James Carville. We're going to see the same staff come in, and I think with the same staff, if you see that same supporting staff come in, you're going to find the same kind of tactics. And those tactics led to a lot of political divisiveness. And again, it was one thing back in the late 1990s, but we're facing in 2008 not just another presidential election, but we're facing the prospect of this wave of baby boomers retiring. And you might have recalled that just last week, Ben Bernanke, the new Federal Reserve chairman, came to the Senate and talked about, you know, in catastrophic terms, about the cataclysmic problems that we are going to face in the very near future unless we address these budget deficits, unless we tackle Social Security and Medicare reform. And it was wonderful to hear the president talk about it last night in very unspecific terms, but it's not going to get done with the same people who haven't been able to tackle it for the past 20 years.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Josh is listening in Crestwood. Hi, Josh.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Dr. Berkey, I read your article, and I thought you had a lot of really good things to say, and I'm agreeing with a lot of what you're saying today. You talk about candidates either right now have fame or money. You know, they have name recognition or they have a lot of money. You mentioned Herb Kohl. What's the answer? How do we break that so we get candidates who don't have a lot of name ID or don't have a lot of money? How do we get good candidates not only to run but to win?
Josh, thank you. Good question. Dr. Berkey.
That's a great question, and it's one I've been wrestling with right now. Ian Mequon, the organization I recently co-founded with a colleague at Concordia University of Wisconsin, Dr. Jeff Waltz, who teaches political science. Dr. Waltz and I have been traveling around South Wisconsin, debating one another. I tend to lean politically to the politically conservative side, and Dr. Waltz to the politically liberal side. We debate one another to try and model effective, civil, and intelligent public discourse on issues like this, because I think it's going to take grassroots involvement from people. The Internet really should be providing a remarkable new opportunity for people at the grassroots level to organize and to get involved and to do something about this, to raise large sums of money through small individual contributions. And we see some of that. We see some of that promise. Look, I'm not a big Howard Dean fan, but look at what Howard Dean was able to do in the last presidential primary season. I'm even astonished to look at what has happened on the Internet with this particular article. The dozens of blogs that have picked this up, and this thing has been bandied all across the country. And the kind of phone calls and response I'm getting on this article alone really, I think, holds out a lot of promise for grassroots organization. And it also tells me that this kind of a message really resonates with people, because I think people are really fed up like never before with this non-responsive government and, again, with this political aristocracy that's dominating Washington.
What did you make of the President's State of the Union last night?
Oh, I'm a political historian, so I'd like to return to the days of the 19th century when our presidents just sent a letter to Washington, D.C. Thomas Jefferson ended the practice of giving State of the Union addresses, and it wasn't until Woodrow Wilson that they started actually giving these addresses again. And that's because with the rise of modern media, first radio and then television, It provided a nice opportunity for a president to come in, get some free airtime, and all of Washington really provide a kind of a manipulative moment. I guess I'm always a little disturbed at the highly choreographed nature of these State of the Union addresses, the stage management that's involved. I'm glad to hear some of the bipartisan messages. I don't have a lot of confidence it's going to happen. If we look back over the past couple of years at some of the proposals we've heard offered in the State of the Union addresses, other than Iraq-related, we hear constantly, again, this theme of dealing with the budget deficit and dealing with earmarks and dealing with Social Security and Medicare, but they don't get tackled. So, again, it leaves me without a real sense of confidence that much is going to happen on that front. So sorry to be so pessimistic, but...
Well, I'm wondering if your pessimism, and I share it to a certain degree in those respects, I wonder if your pessimism might be reflective of a general pessimism that goes along as maybe a third prong in the problem you've outlined. You've got small majorities where victory exists. You have political dynasties that are a real possibility here. And then... you have an electorate that is energized only by its partisanship, only going to the polls to see their candidate win, and not particularly energized by any one given issue or whether anything actually is being accomplished.
Yeah. And I sense that may be changing. And, again, we can look historically to the example of California. California has been a cultural and political trendsetter for quite some time, and we recall Arnold Schwarzenegger's stymied attempts at ramming through some changes in California in a very kind of abrasive, combative, partisan way. It didn't work. I think there was a real clamor for a much more bipartisan, cooperative atmosphere in Sacramento, and I think he's acknowledged it. Now, and again, I'm not a huge fan of many of his positions and some of what is happening. But there's a general popularity. I think there's a real desire on the part of people for the politicians to just come together on some common ground to address issues that aren't getting tackled. And there are a whole range of them, and I've mentioned some of them today, from the entitlements to this budget deficit, to immigration, to energy policy. A lot of stuff that's referenced last night in the State of the Union that just isn't getting addressed because of this caustic partisanship.
Well, then... without making an endorsement, which I'm sure you don't want to make, it's just too early to endorse anybody, but without making an endorsement, who, as you look into the crystal ball of 2008, who's there on the horizon who could be the Harry Truman, the Jimmy Carter, who could be the person where the partisanship is tamped down a little bit, someone who says, all right, let's tackle the problems on both sides?
And that's tough. Again, without making any kind of endorsement, I tend to see that kind of a character in John McCain, who, again, a lot of these candidates have trouble getting through the primaries without playing to the far left or to the far right. McCain's problem has always been getting through, and it was in 2000, getting through the primary process. But I think he's the kind of character who, in a general election, can evoke a wider degree of support among moderate Democrats, people who self-identify as independents. And we know that more and more Americans are self-identifying as independents. That includes Lutherans. And we can also look at the really remarkable rise of Barack Obama. I mean, here's a guy who's incredibly inexperienced. You know, just out of the Illinois State House, 2 years in the Senate, and already he's talking about a presidential run. And I think a lot of that has to do with his demeanor, his perceived ability to be less than partisan, kind of reach across the aisle, to have conversations with people who disagree with him, and to try to reach out in some find some common ground. He's done that, I know, on energy policy in one example in the Senate. So those are just a couple of examples. I think there are others. But as I read in my article, for me it's just anybody but a Bush or a Clinton is really the way to go.
Before we let you go, tell us about Americans for Responsibility in Washington.
Well, you can check out our website. It's responsibilitypac.org. I founded this with Jeff Waltz and the help of some a really bright Concordia University students. We've got a large and growing staff of Concordia University students. And it's really intended to promote this issue of responsibility on a whole range of issues. Because really, I couldn't think of a better word to describe what has been happening in Washington in recent years than irresponsible. Top of our issue is the budget deficit, but there are really a whole range of other issues. Now, I graduated from college just before the 1992 election, and who can forget Ross Perot drilling into the minds of every American a $4 trillion deficit? Well, folks, we've got an $8.5 trillion deficit now, and it's going up to 10 and higher. That's problematic, and it tells us that there's something highly irresponsible going on in Washington, D.C. We're really going to try to combat that at the grassroots level.
How would you respond to someone who's listened and they say, look, your ideas are just ideological utopianism. We can't have what you're hoping for.
I would say it's happened before. And it starts small and it starts somewhere. I'm a political conservative, and I look with inspiration to the 1994 contract with America. Now, I'm the first to lament what has happened to the Republican Party since then. But that started somewhere. It started with somebody in one political district who had an idea, who put these ideas on paper for political reform, term limits, a constitutional amendment to balance the budget, and many of the things that really resonated with people in that district. It worked, it caught on, and then 94 rolls around, and it suddenly became a national campaign that brought Republicans into the House of Representatives for the first time in nearly half a century. It can happen, and it has happened. It just is going to take a degree of activism and optimism that we can make a change, because we live in a country where we've got opportunities that don't exist anywhere in the world.
All right, a very quick call and a very quick response. Matt in Seward, Nebraska. Matt, welcome.
Hi. I've been teaching on Machiavelli in my history class recently, and I think, like Machiavelli says, people say they want a lot of the things you say, but in reality what they really want is what we really get in politics usually, and that's dirty people doing dirty things behind the scenes to keep power.
All right, a very quick response from Dr. Berkey, about 30 seconds to respond.
Well, we've heard that before, that people get the government that they deserve, and that's true to an extent. I'm much more optimistic, though, about what people want. All it takes is responsibility, and it's going to take people with leadership and a real commitment to do what's right for America, and I think those people exist out there.
www.responsibilitypac.org is the website address for Americans for Responsibility in Washington. It's responsibilitypac.org. Dr. James Berkey is Assistant Professor of History at Concordia University, Wisconsin. He's co-founder of this bipartisan political action committee, Responsibility, Americans for Responsibility in Washington, and he's authored this commentary in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch. The title of the commentary, Anyone But a Bush or a Clinton. Dr. Berkey, thanks for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd.
Well, when we come back from this break, we're going to be talking with Dr. Alvin Schmidt. Story from the Washington Post. Headline reads, Temporary Enjoyment Marriages in Vogue Again with Some Iraqis. We'll find out what marriage, divorce, and these enjoyment marriages have to do with Islam, especially in Iraq. Dr. Alvin Schmidt will be our guest. We'll spend the last half hour with Joe Dallas responding to pro-gay rights arguments.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.